Well, good to see you all. Many of you were here last week, and I want to clarify a couple of comments because it got back to me that I was a proponent of open borders, and I listened to myself speak last Sunday, and I didn't say that. So just FYI. The Bible, what I was trying to get at was the scriptures. God's going to judge us on how we treat foreigners and aliens. That's really clear in the text. That's just really super clear in the text. As to the state's policies, I don't know what to do. But how we personally treat foreigners and aliens is super important to the heart of God. So wanted to clarify that. I'm not seeking to be political per se. The trouble is the Bible does. It has political consequences. So today we're going to be in the prophet Zephaniah. How many of you heard a sermon on Zephaniah? Yeah, probably nobody. Even Tim Keller didn't give a sermon on Zephaniah in his 20-plus years of ministry in New York City, and I checked. We're going to be in Zephaniah chapter 3, but I want to start out in chapter 1 a little bit because I want to give you some context to this book. Zephaniah, it's, what, 3 pages long? My Hebrew is a little rusty, but I've been working, trying to get it back up to speed because I love to read Hebrew poetry. There's all sorts of wordplays and beautiful things that go on. And so one of the things I did this week was I listened on YouTube. The cool thing is you can go to YouTube and you can find anything. That's good and bad. And I found a person reading reading the entire book of Zephaniah in Hebrew. It takes about 10 minutes in Hebrew to read it. And I followed along in my Bible, my Hebrew Bible. And it's a beautiful, beautiful poetry. How many of you read poetry in English? Anybody? It's kind of a lost discipline. I think what happened is our schools made us read English song from Shakespeare, and it turned us off to poetry forever and ever, right? It's like, what is this? And a lot of that's prose anyway. I mean, it's just bizarre what's going on with Shakespeare sometimes. But I think we need to bring back poetry and reading poetry. And I like to read Hebrew poetry. I'm not very good at it, but I'm working on it. And Zephaniah is a short little book, 10 minutes to read in Hebrew, 10 minutes to read in English, probably. And Zephaniah, have you found it yet? Yeah, good luck with that, right? If you have the app, it's super easy. It's like, bank, you got it. Or BibleGateway.com or any of those kinds of cool things. You might want to look in your contents. It's one of the minor prophets. And what they mean by minor prophets is they're short prophets. It's not a major prophet like Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel. If you ever have read through the Bible and you keep opening it again to Isaiah or Ezekiel or Jeremiah, and you're like, oh my gosh, is this ever going to end? When do I get to Jesus or something that I understand? Zephaniah, when you get to that in your annual reading, you just zip through it and you're like, cool, I like those prophets. I just zip through those. It's a minor prophet, not because his message is minor or unimportant. It's minor because it's short. And Zephaniah, it tells us at the beginning of the book some about him. Now, well, let me read that first and go back to those. The word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, son of Kush, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, during the reign of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. And it's kind of interesting because this is one of the few prophets that we get him tracing his lineage 3 generations back. And there's some interesting names there. Cushi is perhaps from the ancient kingdom of Cush, which we think of as Ethiopia. So there's a possibility that he has some ancestry in northern Africa. It also has the name Hezekiah in the list. And so there's a scholarly debate raging as to, is this the great grandson of King Hezekiah? Because Hezekiah was one of the kings of Judah. And frankly, we don't know. There's no way to know this. It could be that he is, could be that he isn't. Some scholars go, he definitely is, and here's why. And other scholars go, he definitely isn't, and here's why. And a person like me reads that and goes, I don't know, you don't know, we don't know. But it's interesting. So he traces his lineage back. And then he begins right off the bat with God's judgment. Zephaniah is in a horrible, terrible, very bad place to begin. Now, I want to speak a little bit to why do we read prophets? Why are the lectionary readings the prophets? I mean, this isn't very Christmassy. I will sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Oh, dear. He doesn't sound very happy. I mean, where's the Christmas tree? And you might be confused. Why are the prophets, why do we camp out on the prophets during the Christmas season? And in fact, the lectionary readings this week, there's this one from Zephaniah. There's one from Luke where John the Baptist is preaching and he says to the Pharisees, like I mentioned in the communion meditation, the Pharisees come and he says, you brood of vipers, why are you here? Right? Have you come to repent? And it's like, well, that's not very Christmassy. I mean, where's Jesus and angels and butterflies, right? Where's happy stuff? What's going on? Well, Fleming Rutledge has this quote, Advent is the time for meditating upon the condition of the lost world and the lost people in it. Advent is that historic season in the church calendar. For 2,000 years, this is what churches around the world have done. They have spent this season contemplating, meditating on the brokenness of this world. Now, why? Why would we do that? Because it prepares us for Jesus. It explains why he needs to come. She continues, the great wisdom of the Advent season immediately preceding Christmas is that we are invited all together to prepare ourselves for the Lord's coming by gathering intentionally as a community to hear the truths about the human condition that are hard to bear. These are hard sermons. I understand that. Many times we come and we want to be comforted, not nostalgia. We want a perfect Christmas. But Christmas isn't always very perfect, is it? Christmas can be a time where we are reminded, actually. I mean, as much as our culture tries to keep the pain and the suffering, the difficulty and the evil away, as much as we try to keep that away from our festivities, there are empty seats at the Christmas table, aren't there? I mean, maybe you've lived through the loss of a child, but many of us, we've all lived through the loss of a loved one in some way. We've lost a grandparent or a parent. And Christmas is this time where we get together as friends and family. But our culture is a time, I mean, if it's not death, there's other things that are fracturing families. There's relationships that get all wonky. You ever gotten sideways with a brother or sister? I mean, it's one thing when you're like fifth and sixth grade, you just duke it out and mom comes in, hey, stop that, you're supposed to love your brother, and da da da, and you're like, get one last punch in as she turns to leave the room, you know. But it's a little different when you're 25 and 26, 35, 36, 45, 46, right? It's a little different when you're sideways with brothers and sisters. And by the way, that's just part of life. People are hard to love. How do I know that? Because I'm hard to love. I've been told. I don't believe it, but I've been told that. How about you? Have you been told that or you experienced that? Have you ever had that experience where, you know, maybe it happened for you in late elementary school or middle school or maybe high school where you realized not everybody likes me, right? Some people haven't realized this. They show up on American Idol and they sing. right? And that's where they find out, not everybody likes me. It's like, yeah, you're horrible. Like, who told you you could sing? Advent is the season where we reflect upon these difficult things. And this reading from Zephaniah was a prophet who came to Judah, which is the kingdom of the south, and they still had the city of Jerusalem. They still had the temple. Solomon's temple still exists. And he came during the reign of Josiah. Now, Josiah started out as a boy king. He became king when he was young. And as he grew old, as he grew up, I should say, they found in some, back closet, maybe it was kind of like the area behind the baptistry, right? Like Beth and Rochelle were getting all crazy busy about cleaning up the church and getting things to places that they need to go, and they're finding stuff. And lo and behold, somebody found a Bible in the temple. Now, obviously it wasn't a Bible, but they found the Torah. They found ancient scrolls. Like, what is this? Huh. And they start to read it. Could you imagine a church that had lost its Bibles? And one day they dust it off. Hey, what's this thing? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, they start to read the Torah, and they get to the point where it says the king should keep a copy of this. The king actually needs to hand make his own copy of the Torah. Kids who are here at church, imagine taking pen and paper and starting to copy the entire Bible, right? Now, fortunately, he only had to do the first two-thirds. Well, he actually only had to do the Torah, the first five books. Imagine copying the first five books by hand. And that's what God's idea was. That's what his command to the king was. And the reason he created this command to the king was so that he would know what it is. He'd have his own personal copy. They couldn't run off to Kinko's back then or the Ray Print Shop. They couldn't go online to Google and, what does the Torah say, right? They had to have their own copy. And so God made sure that the king had his own copy. So they take it to Josiah because he's the king. And they came across this part that says king has to have his own copy. So they're like, you better get busy, king. This is a big, long Torah. It says in the text that they started to tear their clothing. I have never felt that impulse when I'm mad. I felt like tearing other people or other things, but I've never felt like I'm just going to tear my clothes. I'm so mad, right? I don't understand that. It's one of those things where when you read the Bible, you realize, stuff's different back then, right? The king and the officials and the priests, they tore their clothes when they discovered the Torah. And they started to realize how far off track that they had become religiously and politically. They start to find out. And so Josiah, he starts in on these reforms with the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And so they start to take all of the false gods, all the idols, all the altars that have been accumulating in the temple of Jerusalem. Now, all the Hebrew stuff is there, okay? The Ark of the Covenant is there. The cherubim in the Holy of Holies, the curtains are still there. The altar to Yahweh is still there. But what they've done is they've kind of added some other things to it. One of their favorite things to add to it that the prophets, and you saw this when we walked through the book of Judges a little bit, the Baals, the Baals, and the Asherahs. Baal was an ancient fertility god in Canaan. It was like a prosperity god. If you wanted more sheep, more camels, if you wanted more money, you worshipped Baal. And he helped you out with stuff. He took care of things. He made sure it rained when you needed rain. He made sure it was hot when you needed it hot. He made sure all that stuff was taken care of for you. And Asherah, in fact, in ancient Israel, we have some inscriptions that say Yahweh and his Asherah. And it's confounded people and it's scary to people. It's like, oh, Yahweh had like a wife. And Yahweh, by the way, if you don't know, that's the Hebrew name for God. And really, these inscriptions, these are folk religion inscriptions. It's telling us about that time when idolatry had taken root in Israel to the point that they lost the Torah, they forgot, they misplaced their Bibles for generations. And all of these influences of the culture around them started to creep in to the temple and then their religion. They didn't abandon Yahweh, they just added to him. They started to add things to their religious experience and belief system. And this book, I think, was written probably and it encouraged, it strengthened Josiah in his reforms. So it says that he took all of the idols out of Yahweh's temple and they cast them down into the Kidron Valley and there they burned them and destroyed them. It says that they took all the high places down. They did all of these reforms under Josiah. But sadly, it was a bit too little, too late. You see, Josiah was the last king of Judah before the Babylonian captivity in 587. Now, chapter 1, verse 3, we see this reversal of Genesis. One of the things that's fascinating with Hebrew poetry is that all the word plays that are going on. And here you see a reversal of the story in Genesis. I will sweep away both man and beast and bird and fish. The order of how those things were created in Genesis, if you remember, right, was the exact reverse of that. Fish and bird and beast and man. And God, through the prophet, is having a little bit of fun here. He's saying, it's going to be devastation. Creation will be utterly destroyed. I will sweep away both man and beast. I will sweep away the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea. And the idols, those are the things that have made their way into Yahweh's temple and on the hillside and in everybody's house. Because even if you had gone to Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit that was in Denver, which will probably never happen again in our lifetime. Oh, that makes me sad. But it was fascinating because they had all of these things from the Antiquities collection in Israel that were these little Baal statues and Asherah statues that people kept in their homes. And the idols that cause the wicked to stumble. When I destroy all mankind on the face of the earth, declares the Lord. God's having a bad day. The earth, though, is having a bad epoch. I mean, this is tragic. This is horrible what's going on in Israel. And God's judgment is coming. Now, it's interesting because unlike the other prophets, Zephaniah never tells us how this will happen. The other prophets, they tell us Babylon's coming. But here, Zephaniah, he never says. In fact, the actor in all of Zephaniah is the Lord. The Lord's doing this to you. He doesn't want the people at all confused with why they are being destroyed. In fact, as we read through the book, and we're not going to do this, but you will continue to read through this book, and you will see that the temple will be destroyed. The walls around Jerusalem will be leveled, knocked down. The city of Jerusalem will be utterly decimated. You know when you watch TV and you see the Jews at the Wailing Wall, crying, praying, rocking? Well, that's not this temple that they're at that's talked about that's going to be destroyed. Do you know why that's not this temple? Because that one was utterly destroyed. It didn't remain. It was pulled apart. burned down, demolished by the Babylonians. So was their wall, safety, their security. If you skip down to verse 15, that day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds. We get it, right? This is a bad day. This is a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day is what the Zephaniah is telling us. This day of the Lord that's coming is a terrible, horrible day. Verse 18, there's nothing that can save you. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of the Lord's wrath. In the fire of his jealousy, the whole earth will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live on the earth. Merry Christmas. Wow. Okay, that's painful. This can't possibly be the Advent reading. It's not. The Advent reading is actually Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 14 through 20. I want you to have context, because you need to know why the promise, why the hope is so hopeful. Why it's so powerful. Why Zephaniah chapter 3 is important. But before we do that, we got to wreck our days a little bit more. Zephaniah 3, chapter 2. The Zephaniah chapter 3, it like reiterates all of the destruction. It reiterates how bad Jerusalem is. It reiterates that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. But it also, throughout the book, it starts to give us hope. There's this remnant. There's this remnant of the humble. There's the remnant of those who turn their face and repent and turn to Yahweh. And Zephaniah 3, it has these themes in it. So the first part of Zephaniah, verse 1, or chapter 3, first part 3, like 1 through 9 or 8, continues the judgment. But then there's this abrupt shift to hope. She obeys no one. Now he's talking about Jerusalem. She obeys no one. She accepts no correction. She does not trust in the Lord. She does not draw near to her God. It's so ironic because in the ancient worldview, where you would draw near to your God was the temple. And these people are really religious people. They go to the temple. They make the sacrifices. The trouble is they've added to the religion. They've added other gods and goddesses. They've added other practices. They've added other festivals. There's all of this extra that they've added. And they're not drawing near to God. They're drawing near to something, not to him. Question. Could we possibly be guilty of this? Could we in modern day America, is there any possibility that we may have Jesus plus as our formula for being a good Christian or being a good church member or being a good American, right? Is there any way that we could have Jesus plus? Did you hear the words of that last part? Jealousy is the language of the prophets. God is a jealous God, made Oprah really mad. Oprah doesn't like the idea that the Hebrew Bible teaches that God is jealous. Jealousy, oh, that's just, you know, that's so old-fashioned, old school, that's bad. But the relationship that God has with his people is like a jealous husband for his adulterous wife. That's the language that the prophets use regularly. That's the language that God uses to define his relationship and what's going on with him and Israel. I am a jealous husband. You are a stray wife. They do not draw near to God. They're not faithful to Yahweh. Their allegiance is all over the place. They're not allegiant to Yahweh. And I wonder, could we be like that? For years, when I was in Denver Seminary, I wanted to go on and do my work on a PhD in the Old Testament. And the area that bothered me the most in the Old Testament, do you know what? I mean, I've shared this before. The big sin in the Old Testament, the huge sin in the Old Testament, it's not adultery, it's not murder. The big sin in the Old Testament is idolatry. And guess what? It's the same big sin in the New Testament. It's the unforgivable sin, idolatry. It's the sin that led Israel into exile, idolatry. In one of John's letters, he says, "My dear children, flee idols." What is an idol? We'd probably be wise to figure this out. If this is the big sin, if this is God's big beef with humanity, what is an idol? Let me be really honest with you. I know what an idol is in the ancient world. Totally makes sense to me. Wood figurine, stone figurine, doing some kind of sacrifice to that idol in some way. Sacrificing your child to Molech, the god of child sacrifice in the ancient world. That makes sense. I can see that. And I'm starting to wrestle with this idea that maybe idolatry is kind of like greed. And what I mean by that is greed is way easier to see in other people than in me. Right? I mean, you can just see a greedy person, right? You go, oh, they're just greedy, right? But greed in us is super hard to see. Maybe idolatry's like that. Maybe idolatry is easy to see in other people, but really hard to see in us. I mean, maybe we're so convinced that I am allegiant to King Jesus and Him only. We're just thinking that that's what it is, but we've got all these little plus signs we've added to that. I'm wondering and I'm wrestling and I'm trying to figure this out. If you have insights on this, if you study these things and you come across something, let me know. This is a worthwhile study of the scriptures. What is idolatry? Well, I turned to Google for some answers, right? I mean, I Googled, like, what's an American idol today? And then I got, like, results for singers. I'm like, okay, I got to change the search parameters, right? I did listen to a couple of good songs, about 30, 40 minutes I spent. And I'm like, oh, that's a good song. And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this isn't helping with my sermon prep. Almost shared with you a couple songs, but I got back to it. What are modern-day idols that Americans have? There's an interesting list. I came across different lists. Some think it's, sex or pleasure is an idol. Some think power is an idol. Some think money is an idol. And I keep wrestling. I'm like, I know people who really make a big deal of those things, but I don't know anybody that worship them. Like, to go and tell them, hey, you need to stop that, they'd be like, yeah, you're right, I'm totally, like, you know, for the most part, people aren't going to, that's not, now there are people in our society that maybe the identity stuff that's going on with homosexuality, and it's getting into identity of how I define my sexual orientation, maybe that's starting to move into that direction. I'm not quite sure. Like I said, I'm exploring these things. But this is what God condemns throughout the prophets. And I'm just wondering, what have you added to Jesus In fact, I came across this. I think this might be helpful. Jacques Ellul, he is a French sociologist and theologian, and he said that here's our questions that may be able to help unveil idols in our time. He says, in whom or in what do we place our trust? In whom or in what do you place your trust? Like if you get, you know, bad news about your marriage, your kid, your job, your health, what do you trust in? Do you trust in the principles of Dave Ramsey, you know, setting aside an emergency fund in case the job ends? Do you place your trust in your own wisdom, talent, ability? I'll figure it out. I'm just going to soldier through. We will get this taken care of. We'll make it happen. Be okay. Do you put your faith, your trust in government or authorities? The way you know that you might do this is you say, well, they'll figure it out. They will take care of it. Kids, you can know that you trust in mom and dad because you'll say, they'll fix it for us. Where do you put your faith, your trust? Another question. Where do we look for security and happiness? That's a really interesting question. Where do we look for security and happiness? Do we look for it in experiences, in things, in stuff, in people? Where do you look for security and happiness? Another question. Whom do we expect to guarantee our future? I mean, there's a whole industry based around that. You watch a football game and you quickly learn about all these investment groups that want to help you manage your money so you can get on the right path that leads to retirement. Who do you trust for your future? Fidelity? Vanguard? Your own smarts? What do you think can guard our liberty? Strong military? A wall? The right people in power? The right judges? What can guard our liberty? And whom do we believe on the subject of truth? We live in such a weird era, don't we? Fake news. Who do you believe on the subject of truth? Perhaps these are good questions for us to wrestle through on our quest for understanding modern day idols. God starts to change his tune and he starts to encourage the people. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day I will stand up to testify, I have decided to assemble the nations, to gather the kingdoms, and to pour out my wrath on them, all my fierce anger. The whole world will be consumed by the fire of my jealousy. Okay, that's the wrong verse. He didn't change his tune yet. Here, though. Now we start to learn what this fire does. We find out it's not a destroying fire, it's a purifying fire. Then I will purify the lips of the peoples, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord and serve him shoulder to shoulder. Don't you love that? Shoulder to shoulder. It's like God's got a team in mind. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshipers, my scattered people will bring me offerings. On that day, Jerusalem will not be put to shame for all the wrongs you have done to me, because I will remove from you your arrogant boasters. Never again will you be haughty on my holy hill, but I will leave within you the meek and humble. The remnant of Israel will trust in the name of the Lord. They will do no wrong. They will tell no lies. A deceitful tongue will not be found in their mouths. They will eat and lie down, and no one will make them afraid. Sing, daughter Zion. Shout aloud, Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all your heart, daughter Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your punishment. He has turned back your enemy. The Lord, the King of Israel, is with you. Never again will you fear any harm. On that day, they will say to Jerusalem, do not fear, Zion. Do not let your hands hang limp, is a way of saying, get to work. The Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. Wow. God changed the tune. Like, literally. Isn't that cool? That's why poetry is so powerful. Do you catch? Do you feel it? Do you understand what's happening? Do you see this future that's promised to this remnant of Israel? And scholars, the New Testament picked up on these themes in Zephaniah because Jesus showed up and then he died, but then he rose again, and it still hadn't quite happened, and everybody's waiting for this day where God, the mighty warrior, will show up and put the world to rights, and everybody in Zion and the nations will sing God's praise, and God will sing over us, and God will be in our midst. They're all still waiting for this day. We are still waiting for this day. I will remove from you all who mourn. Can you imagine? Over the loss of your appointed festivals, which is a burden and a reproach for you. At that time, I will deal with all who oppressed you. I will rescue the lame. I will gather the exiles. I will give them praise and honor in every land where they have suffered shame. Any question who's doing this? At that time, I will gather you. At that time, I will bring you home. I will give you honor and praise among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your very eyes, says the Lord. Did you hear the eyes in there? Who's doing this? Who should we trust with our futures? Who should we trust with our security? Who should we trust with our very lives? Who should we trust? You see, I think that's why adultery is so yucky. Because we are so blind. So easy for us to trust in the wrong things. It's so easy for us to get lost. I want to leave you with a hope and a promise. Do you hear that promise? I mean, I just got to read the text again, and don't you feel it? I love the end of that line. I will restore your futures before your very eyes. I think Americans really like that line. Because I know a lot of people are like, I ain't going to believe it till I see it. I've said that a lot of times, especially like about weather predictions in Colorado, right? I'll believe it when I see it. There's going to be 30 feet of snow. I'll believe it when I see it, right? God will do this before our very eyes. Who will he do this for? The faithful. Those who follow Jesus. Those who through baptism have identified with Jesus Christ, his life, his death, his burial. Those who are followers, disciples of Jesus Christ. This is a promise for us. That God will restore your fortunes before your very eyes. Now, I don't know what you're going through in your life, but my guess is if you're like me, you've got some stuff in your life that's hard, difficult. There is suffering. There is pain. And you may be taking steps to medicate it. You may be taking steps to take care of it. You may be in your own wisdom or in your own sinfulness trying to figure out how to deal with that pain. How to deal with that suffering. How to deal with those tragedies. How to deal with these things. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that the answer from God is this:
wait and see.
Now, I got to be honest. There's a lot of days I don't like that answer. There's a lot of days I'm like, you know what? I think I'll just go throw a pizza in the oven and I'm going to eat the whole thing and I'll feel better for a while and then I won't feel better for a while, right? Or maybe your thing is, you know, I'll just go and I'll smoke some weed and I'll feel better for a little while and then I won't feel better. Or maybe your thing is alcohol and I'll feel better for a little while and then I won't feel better for a little. Maybe your thing's buying stuff. I'll jump on Amazon and I'll buy some stuff and I'll feel better for a little while and then I won't feel better for a little while. And we want to fix our pain. We self-medicate and we turn to broken, empty cisterns. We turn to wells that are dry. They give us a quick little drink, but then it's just gone. And God's answer is wait and see. I will restore your fortunes before your eyes. Gosh, who wants, who, you'd be a fool to miss out on that day. This is the hope of the gospel. This is the hope of that infant child born on Christmas. This is the Christian hope that God will restore our fortunes before our very eyes. Man, I look forward to that day. I look forward to seeing some of you and your fortunes restored because of the stuff you've walked through. I so look forward to that day. Don't you? Wait and see. Let us pray. Father, I thank you for these good folks, their patience. I pray that you'd bless us. Bless these hearers of your promise, of your word. For those of us that find these words maybe too good to be true. Thank you that you said you're going to see it. We look forward to that day. We long for that day. We read Advent stories all over the place in this fallen, broken world. We look forward to the rightful King coming. Help us to be patient. Please keep us from letting our hands hang limp and let us roll up our sleeves and get to work. Help us to bring your kingdom to bear in this world. And Lord, let us place all of our allegiance, all of our faith, all of our trust, all of our loyalty to you. We ask this in your name. Now may the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. Wait and see. Amen.